Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. Here is our second podcast. And today we're largely going to talk about viruses. And before I go into that, I'd just like to wish every woman out there a happy Women's Day. You certainly put up with a lot of crap on a daily basis. And we appreciate your work, your efforts, and the wonderful things you do for humanity. Okay, so let's go ahead and begin. So, HIV patient, and just real quick, this is going to probably be in like three parts. The ultimate goal is to cover all the material relating to viruses that's tested on the USMLE step one. So this podcast will just basically go into some detail on like a third of the material. Okay, we're basically talking about the big girl viruses today, like the HIV, the HSV, the herpes viruses, and all that fun stuff. Okay, so let's start. Now, the first question says, HIV patient presents with disseminated raised skin lesions with central umbilication, right? So, raised skin lesion, central umbilication, hopefully you're thinking of molluscum contagiosum, okay? Molluscum contagiosum. And remember that it is in fact a kind of pox virus. And the way this is spread is basically by direct contact. So if you have contact with the lesions, you get into trouble. And while we're on the subject of pox viruses, again, one of the annoying things that step one will want you to know is that the pox viruses, they have their own envelope, and they replicate in the cytosol, which is kind of different from other viruses. They do replicate in the cytosol. So they actually come with their own RNA polymerases. Okay? They come with their own RNA polymerases. And they even make their own surrounding envelope. Okay? So those are just high-yield things to know. Now, remember that of your pox viruses, you also have like cowpox. That's the thing that's classically known as the milkmaid's blisters. It sort of presents very similarly to varicella zoster, which is a kind of herpes virus. But in varicella zoster, the lesions are in different stages of healing. In cowpox, the lesions are typically like in the same stage of healing. So just something there to sort of help yourself out. Okay, and then remember that there's such a thing as chicken pox. Chicken pox is vaccine preventable. Okay, you get the vaccine, you don't get the bug. Okay, so let's see. So the second one. So a patient on natalizumab presents with a 3-week history of quadriplegia. MRI is notable for an increased preponderance of white matter lesions. So natalizumab is a drug you've probably heard of, right? It's a drug that's used to treat multiple sclerosis. It's an inhibitor of alpha-4 integrin. So when you inhibit alpha-4 integrin, the inflammatory cells that mediate a lot of the damage in MS do not go through endothelial cell barriers, and they don't cause any havoc in the central nervous system. Okay, so if they describe a person, I mean, people with MS have neurologic deficits, but if you notice the rapidly progressive nature of these neurologic deficits, and you know I'm talking about viruses, I am really hoping you're thinking about the JC virus and progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy. Okay, so it presents as massive demyelination in the central nervous system, and it can cause like a very rapidly progressive set of neurologic issues. Okay, and the classic populations affected, one population are HIV patients that have very low CD4 counts, usually it's less than 50, and it also affects people that are taking natalizumab, okay, for multiple sclerosis. You can also see a rituximab association, but it's primarily natalizumab and HIV patients that are tested on the boards. Okay, now, next question says hemorrhagic cystitis in a patient who recently got a kidney transplant. This is also a related virus, because the thing is, the JC virus is actually a polyoma virus. The BK virus is also a polyoma virus. And the BK virus, the classic presentation is a person that had a kidney transplant presents with red urine. You want to think about hemorrhagic cystitis and think of that being secondary to the BK virus. Okay, that's literally all you need to know about that bug. And so I don't forget the polyomaviruses. You definitely want to know that they are non-envelope viruses, okay? They are double-stranded DNA viruses. They have a circular genome, and they are icosahedral, okay? I know it's kind of annoying, but step one classically puts these questions where they tell you everything in the question. You're like, oh, I know the bug. I know the answer. And then you read the answer choices, and you're like, man, are you kidding? And the answer choices have like circular, helical, negative, single-stranded, blah, 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 blah. Okay? So these little details, they're very good for flashcard material. They are things you definitely want to know. And then at the bottom of the slide, I mentioned all the high-yield causes of hemorrhagic cystitis. So two bugs and one drug. So in addition to the BK virus, remember that adenovirus, the classic cause of pink eye, so the buzzword there is pharyngoconjunctivitis, okay, causes a hemorrhagic cystitis. And then also remember that schistosoma hematobium, right? So if they mention anything about Egypt in an exam question or some guy swimming in the Nile, and then the guy has red urine, you want to think about a hemorrhagic cystitis from a schistosoma hematobium, okay? And remember that schistosoma hematobium, you get that through like direct skin penetration. Okay, and then the one big drug, I hope you're thinking of the alkylating agent cyclophosphamide. Remember, one of its metabolites known as acrolein. Okay, it's very toxic to the bladder. Okay, and you can prevent that by giving Mesna. Okay, Mesna can bind up that nasty acrolein breakdown product of cyclophosphamide. You could also potentially give in acetylcysteine. It also sort of works for that purpose as well. Okay, next question. So pet store owner is rushed to the hospital by ambulance with a 24-hour history of bloody diarrhea and vomiting. Physical exam is notable for hemorrhagic, ocular, and oral effusions. He returned from a one-week trip to Nigeria where he performed studies on rats. Ding, ding, ding. So if you see a person that is having hemorrhage from like every notable orifice in the body, and you see a rat history, a history of rat exposure, you really want to think about Lassa fever. Okay, Lassa fever, it's a kind of RNA virus. It's a single-stranded RNA virus. But Lassa fever, rat exposure. Okay, and while we're on the topic of rats, if they describe a person, remember that leptospirosis, right? So it's a spirochete, Leptospira interrogans. It classically causes like ocular lesions as well. And they always mention like some history of like visiting Hawaii or swimming in like some body of water that has like rat urine or some other kind of rodent urine. Okay, so that's another rat association to sort of keep in mind. Okay, and Lassa fever is caused by the Lassa virus. You can treat it with ribavirin, but that's like mega low yield. It's probably no yield for the exam, but I guess if it showed up out of the blue, you'll be thankful you knew the answer. Okay, so next slide. So 17-year-old female who went spelunking 3 months ago. Oops, sorry, let me correct that. One of the benefits of having Google Drive. So 17-year-old female who went spelunking 3 months ago is comatose in the ICU. She was initially brought to the hospital by concerned family members when she did not bathe or eat or drink for a two-week period. So what's the diagnosis, right? So I sort of wrote these questions to kind of throw people off and I guess force you to think a little harder than normal, okay? Because if you see spelunking, you're like, oh, histoplasma capsulatum. But histoplasmosis does not make you comatose and it does not make you not want to eat or drink or bathe, okay? So I guess while I'm on this, I'll just go ahead and talk about this test taking strategy. If information is not given in a QSTEM, okay, do not try to make up information that will make an answer that you're really eyeing sound really good, okay? I didn't say anything about a pulmonary infection or cough or anything like that. So don't assume that information to be true, okay? So on an exam, they'll potentially put histo as an answer choice. Do not pick that answer choice, okay? Now, so this person, if you go spelunking, right, let's assume you potentially were exposed to a bat or a skunk, okay? And then you're beginning to have all these problems, right? So you don't want to bathe because you're trying to avoid water. You don't want to eat or drink because you have like spasm of your pharyngeal muscles, or you're sort of like trying to like, oh, not taking any kind of water. With all these clues I've given you, what are you thinking about? I hope you're thinking about rabies. Okay, remember, rabies has a bat association, a skunk association, a raccoon association. Dogs could also transmit rabies, but that's classically not in the U.S. That's more in like foreign countries, because in the U.S., dogs get very good vaccinations. Okay, so this is rabies. Okay, and remember, on histology, you'd potentially see something known as a negri body. Okay, a negri body on histology is like an eosinophilic I believe it's a cytoplasmic inclusion that you tend to find in some cells in the brain, like CNS rabies, like in Purkinje cells or pyramidal cells or things like that. Okay, and the cell biology tie-in here is that rabies, the thing it does is it initially infects like skeletal muscle cells. Okay, it can also infect neurons initially, but it usually infects the skeletal muscle cells, and then it finds its way, so it usually gets in through like a nicotinic acetylcholine receptor, and then it finds its way and then begins to infect neurons. Okay, and it then goes in retrograde transport with in neurons all the way back to the CNS, and then when it gets to the CNS, you're screwed pretty much. Okay. And the thing is, the cell biology time I'm trying to talk about here is step one could make an unusual question where they talk about antigrade versus retrograde transport. Okay, remember, antigrade transport is mediated by kinesins. Okay, that's a kind of motor protein, and then retrograde transport, which is what the rabies virus uses, will be mediated more by dynins. Okay, the dynin motor protein. So that's just something to sort of keep in mind. Now, if they ask about the next step in management after a person has been potentially exposed to rabies virus infection, you definitely want to think about giving the person the vaccine, okay? But you also want to give the person rabies immune globulin, because once rabies gets to the CNS, that is pretty much the end. You definitely do not want to be under those conditions. Okay? And rabies causes like foaming at the mouth, so like a lot of hypersalivation. And it's just from a dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system. The psychiatric med that's associated with hypersalivation is also the one of the psych meds that have been shown to improve survival. And I guess in psych, if you say improve survival, it means reduce the risk of suicide. It's an atypical antipsychotic, which is a clozapine. Okay, remember the association with agranulocytosis with that. Now, the next slide, a 3-year-old male from San Francisco has lipase and amylase elevations at 5 times the upper limit of normal, right? So hopefully you're thinking of pancreatitis with that. Has big testicles, okay? Big parotids and low-grade fevers, okay? So what do you think? It's a vaccine-preventable illness. That's the hint I'll give you. So this is mumps, okay? So this is the mumps virus. Remember, it causes a parotiditis, also causes an orchitis, okay? And you could prevent this by getting the vaccine, okay? Don't be an anti-vaxxer. Never does good for anyone, okay? And if you get a question, so while we're on the topic of big testicles, if you may, if you get a question about a boy with enlarged testicles and a long face and large ears and moderate mental retardation, I'm hoping you're thinking of Fragile X syndrome. Okay, it's one of those trinucleotide repeat disorders. But unlike most of the others, it's not autosomal dominant inheritance. It's actually X-linked inheritance. Okay, so in general, a girl does not have Fragile X syndrome on USMLE exams. It's boys. Okay, and the pathophysiology is from having CGG repeats. Okay, so you have a relatively unstable X chromosome. Okay, so CGG repeats, X-linked inheritance, and classically shows up in boys. Okay, now next slide. Discussion of the herpes viruses. Okay, so the herpes viruses. Herpes is super, super high yield to know about for your exam. So let's say some things about herpes. First, I'll talk about some general characteristics, right? So clearly, herpes is a DNA virus, right? It's a double-stranded DNA virus. I will say that probably the only high-yield single-stranded DNA virus you need to know for step one is parvo B19, right? Which causes an aplastic crisis in a sickle cell patients, okay? So the herpes viruses, they're double-stranded DNA viruses. They have an icosahedral capsid. Most DNA viruses, not always true, but most of them do in fact have an icosahedral capsid. Okay, it's an enveloped virus. Okay, and it's like mega high yield to know that herpes gets its envelope from the nuclear membrane. Okay, from the nuclear membrane. That's why, again, if you do a Zank smear, you see an intranuclear inclusion. Okay, because it's assembled in the nucleus. Okay. You may occasionally see like multinucleated giant cells also on the Zank smear. And again, the reasoning behind that is many DNA viruses, of which the herpes virus is a class, is a part, they have something called a fusion protein. And a fusion protein is just basically what they use to attach one cell to the other to begin to move from cell to cell, cell to cell. Okay, so when you have that movement from cell to cell and you have all those cells fused together, you form the multinucleated giant cell. Okay, it's a kind of a syncytium. Now, so let's just sort of go down the herpes viruses one by one. Okay, so human herpes virus 1, okay, and human herpes virus 2, right? So that's HSV 1 and 2. Okay, so for HSV1, the classic description is you'll find lesions above the waist, okay, versus HSV2, where you find lesions below the waist. That's not always true, but it's a rough approximation. Okay, so what are the high yield things you want to know about these bugs? Okay, especially HSV1. For HSV1, it can cause a kind of conjunctivitis. Okay, in fact, if you see the buzzword dendritic ulcers on fundoscopic exam, classically in an immunocompromised patient, think about HSV conjunctivitis. Okay, and remember that HSV1 can cause an encephalitis, classically of the temporal lobes. Okay, so if you see like lesions on MRI in the temporal lobes, and a person is like somnolent and they have like an altered mental status, you want to think about HSV temporal lobe encephalitis. Okay, and then if a person has meningitis with herpes, the classic finding, this is very classic on MBME exams. If you see a person that has, you do a lumbar puncture, you see the CSF, you see like a ton of red cells, you can practically stop reading the question and go ahead and pick herpes. Okay, that is the classic way it's presented on these MBME exams. Okay, and how would you treat herpes infection, right? You would give acyclovir. If you have like meningitis, you probably go ahead and give IV acyclovir. Remember the association with nephrolithiasis with acyclovir, but it's a relatively clean drug. And remember that for acyclovir to work, right, it needs to be activated by a thymidine kinase that is expressed solely by the herpes virus. Okay, so that's why it does not classically cause like bone marrow problems in humans. And contrast that with the CMV treatment, ganciclovir. It's not activated by a thymidine kinase, it's activated by a UL97 kinase. Okay, so if you obviously have mutations in these kinases, you will have resistance to these drugs. And then if you have like acyclovir resistant herpes, you can go ahead and give a foscarnet. Remember, it's a pyrophosphate analog. Okay, and then HSV2, like I said, classically it's below the waist, causes like painful vesicles on an erythematous base, and it actually lays dormant in the sacral ganglia. Contrast that with HSV1 that lays dormant in the trigeminal ganglion. Okay, in the trigeminal ganglion. Okay, and how do you diagnose herpes? Most people will go ahead and do a PCR at this point, but you may still see the Zank smear business on the USMLE. The Zank smear basically helps you detect HSV 1, 2, and 3. Okay, so you really cannot tell the herpes simplex virus apart from the VZV virus on a Zank smear. Okay, that's why, again, most people go ahead and just do the PCR. Okay, so moving on. So herpes 3, that's a VZV. Okay, you'll get this through like respiratory droplets. You can also get it by direct contact, but think about it. If you see like the shingles lesion or the VZV lesion on a person's skin, you're probably not gonna touch it, right? You won't like knowingly say, oh, let me just smother these lesions on your skin. No, you don't do that, so you don't get infected. So the respiratory route is the primary route of transmission of the VZV virus. And these methods of transmission, believe it or not, are very high yield for the test. So, classic description, right? Vesicles in different stages of development. Contrast that with the smallpox virus we talked about, where you have lesions in the same stage, okay? In VZV, you classically see like dermatomal distribution of lesions in different stages of healing, okay? And it tends to lay dormant in the dorsal root ganglion, okay? In some people, it also lays dormant, especially for like ocular VZV or for like VZV on the face, lays dormant in the trigeminal ganglion, okay? And it can reactivate as shingles later in life. So classically, that's in a dermatomal distribution. And that's why you want to get the shingles vaccine, at least a booster vaccine, when you hit the age of 60. Okay, and again, you can treat VZV with like acyclovir. If it's resistant, you can give the classic Foscarnet. And if they give you an exam question about a person that got the VZV vaccine, especially a kid, okay, and then they have like very low blood glucose levels and they have like, they're like comatose. You want to think about Reye syndrome with the administration of aspirin. Remember, the only kids that should get aspirin are kids that have Kawasaki's disease, okay? Not kids that have like a viral infection, like a febrile viral infection. If you give them aspirin, although it's like super, super rare, but there is a very strong association with aspirin administration and the Reye syndrome with kids that have like febrile viral illnesses, okay? Now, VZV is in fact vaccine preventable. Okay, it's a live attenuated virus vaccine. So if a person is severely immunocompromised or a kid that's less than 1 year old or a pregnant woman, you probably do not want to give them the VZV vaccine, okay? But if a mom has been exposed to VZV or a neonate has been exposed to VZV, the treatment in that instance is to give the varicella zoster immune globulin, okay? So VZIG, okay? You do not give the vaccine, you give VZIG, okay? Now, let's go on to herpes 4. So that is EBV, okay? So remember the B in EBV as telling you the cell that is classically infected by EBV, okay? So EBV infects B cells, okay? And it's also, and it actually gets in through the CD21 receptor, okay? It's one of those high yield things you want to know. And it actually also stays latent in B cells, okay? So sort of think about this. If EBV stays latent in B cells, that should sort of explain why EBV causes many B cell problems, okay? So for example, it can cause a Burkitt's lymphoma, okay? Remember the association with an 814 translocation and the starry sky appearance on histology, okay? It could also cause a CNS lymphoma, okay? Classically, that's like a single ring enhancing lesion on MRI in a patient with a history of HIV, okay? Or like severe AIDS, okay? And the thing is, these B cells, your immune system is like, man, let me go and deal with these B cells and sort of knock them out. It sends T cells to the rescue. And those T cells, you can actually see them on a blood smear. Those are the cells that are known as the Downy cells that are classically associated with EBV, okay? And EBV, just another cancer tie-in here, loves to infect nasopharyngeal epithelial cells, okay? So it does, in fact, have an association with nasopharyngeal carcinoma. Okay, and how do you diagnose EBV? You do the monospot test, okay? It's classically monospot positive. If you see like monospot negative mononucleosis syndrome, you're probably thinking more along the lines of CMV, okay? And again, the way EBV will present is a youngish person, okay? Let's assume they've potentially kissed someone recently. And then they present with pharyngitis that sort of looks like strep pneumo. Strep pyogenes. Well, there are differences, right? So first things first is the age range, right? Like, let's assume little kids do not kiss other people, okay? Let's assume it's the, you know, the more sexually active young person that's kissing other people, okay? So a youngish person, like a teenager, okay, presenting with pharyngitis, they have more posterior cervical lymphadenopathy. Contrast that with the anterior cervical lymphadenopathy you get with strep pyogenes, okay? And they also like feel like super fatigued, like wiped out, and they have like splenomegaly, okay? That's why they are classically told to avoid contact sports, okay? So if you see all those things, get the monospot test. If it's positive, you're thinking EBV, okay? And remember that EBV causes some, besides a CNS lymphoma in AIDS patients, it also causes something known as an oral hairy leukoplakia, Okay, so basically it's like you see like hairy like projections from the tongue, and it's not scrapable unlike the lesions you find with Candida and oral thrush. Okay, so let's go to herpes 5. Okay, this is CMV. Okay, CMV, you can transmit it in many ways, right? So by getting blood, by getting a transplant, that's a classic association on exams. From sexual or transmission, you can also get that. And this is classically monospot negative, unlike EBV, that's monospot positive. Okay, and it doesn't stay latent in some weird ganglion. It actually stays latent in mononuclear cells. Okay, stays latent in mononuclear cells. And the classic description of the lesions you see on histology, intranuclear owl's eye inclusions. Okay, so you definitely want to know that for CMV. It is in fact the most common congenital infection in the US. The way it presents as like a blueberry muffin rash, and this kid almost always has a, at least on exams, not in the real world, but on exams, has a like sensory neural hearing loss. They'll have like jaundice, they'll have like big spleen, big liver, so hepatosplenomegaly, and they tend to have calcifications in the brain. So here's the thing, remember that toxoplasmosis can present as a blueberry muffin rash, just the same way that CMV presents as a blueberry muffin rash. And toxoplasmosis can also present as calcifications in the brain, just the same way that CMV presents with calcifications in the brain. But the big thing, and they almost always have to put this on exams to get you to pick the right answer, is the calcification distribution in CMV. It's periventricular. Okay, if you see periventricular calcifications on like brain imaging of a neonate, stop reading the question and pick congenital CMV. Okay, versus the intracranial calcifications. So you find calcifications like in the cortex and all over in toxoplasmosis. Okay, and some other associations for CMV, right? So in transplant patients or AIDS patients, it tends to cause like a retinitis. It can cause like a severe inflammation of the colon, so colitis. You can also get esophagitis with CMV, actually, okay? Remember, the CMV esophagitis has the linear ulcers. Contrast that with HSV esophagitis that has the punched out ulcers in the esophagus, okay? And you treat CMV with ganciclovir. Okay, remember, that's activated by the UL97 kinase, okay? So that's also the mechanism of resistance. And if that's resistant, you can go ahead and give foscarnet. Okay, and ganciclovir, the high yield side effect you want to know is the bone marrow suppression with that. Okay, now herpes 6 causes something called exanthem subitum. Okay, I like the way it sort of rolls off the tongue. That's the roseola virus. Okay, this is again transmitted via respiratory droplets. Okay, and practically the only thing you need to know about this is they describe a child that has super high fevers, like 105, 106, and then boom, the fevers resolve, and then like 2-3 days later, you see this rash that shows up classically on the cheeks. If you see that, you really want to think about the roseola virus, okay? Herpes 6, okay? Now, herpes 8, the big thing you want to know is this is the Kaposi's sarcoma herpes virus. Okay, classically it affects AIDS patients. Okay, so you see like the purplish lesions on the skin. Okay, it's an angioproliferative malignancy, if you may. And the mechanism behind that is that HHV8 does in fact express a gene that activates a vascular endothelial growth factor. Okay, that's why it's like an angioproliferative malignancy. And one thing they will try to trip you up with on step one is distinguishing Kaposi's sarcoma from bacillary angiomatosis, okay? Because the presentation is extremely similar, okay? So the thing is, in bacillary angiomatosis, they'll sometimes give you a history of exposure to cats, okay? Because remember, it's known as the cat scratch disease, and it's transmitted by Bartonella henselae, okay? Another thing they could say is, they did a biopsy of the skin lesions, and you saw a ton of lymphocytes. If you see a ton of lymphocytes, that is Kaposi's sarcoma. If you see a ton of neutrophils, that is bacillary angiomatosis, okay, from Bartonella henselae. Okay, remember the Werfen starry stain that's used for Bartonella. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about the herpes viruses. Hopefully you find that useful. And I know this is kind of going long, so we're going to try to finish up relatively quickly. Next question says, a 12-month-old child with wheezing. There's no family history of asthma or atopy. The child had a sore throat and rhinorrhea for the past week, right? So you're seeing like a viral-like presentation and the kid has wheezing. So you're thinking more of a lower respiratory tract infection. Hopefully you know this is RSV, the respiratory syncytial virus. Okay, RSV, it's the respiratory syncytial virus. It's a paramyxovirus, so it's a single-stranded RNA virus and it's enveloped. Okay, it's an enveloped virus. Now, if you hear wheezing in a kid that is less than 2 years old, or classically less than 12 months old, you should have a very good reason for not picking RSV. Okay, and the way you treat RSV, it's really controversial, but you could potentially give ribavirin. It works in some people, doesn't work in others. Okay, and you could prevent RSV, especially in a kid that has like a very high risk of recurrent like respiratory infections. So let's say they have like Cartagena syndrome, or they have like cystic fibrosis. You'd want to prophylax against that by giving a monoclonal against the RSV virus. Okay, in this case, that would be a palivizumab. And if you see a kid that is less than 5 to 6 years old on an MBME with a stridor, so stridor is more indicative of an upper respiratory tract infection. The things you sort of kind of want to think about are either a supraglottic infection, so epiglottitis, classically caused by H flu type B, or a subglottic infection with the parainfluenza virus, which is croup. Okay, classically croup, you see the wine bottle sign, or you could see the steeple sign on a neck x-ray. Okay, so those are things you want to think about with that. Now, the last two slides basically talk about HIV, right? So in this slide, hopefully you see my writing, I talk about the life cycle of HIV and sort of introduce the pharmacology. Okay, so basically HIV, it binds to CD4 with GP120. Okay, remember GP120 is encoded by the ONV gene. Okay, so GP120 changes conformation, and then that conformational change sort of expresses a binding site for like CCR5 or CXCR4. Okay, and then when GP120 binds to those two things I just mentioned, you have a tight binding interaction that draws GP41 closer to the cell that's about to be infected. Okay, and then that GP41 fuses with the cell, and it so happens that you can block GP41 with a drug known as enfovirtide. Okay, it's a fusion inhibitor. Alternatively, you can also block CCR5. Okay, CCR5 is a chemokine receptor. You can block that with maraviroc. Okay, and one nifty step one question they could ask is making sure you check that a person has a CCR5 tropic virus before you give like maraviroc. Same business with enfovirtide. In fact, maraviroc and enfovirtide only work in HIV1. They do not work in HIV2. Just a high yield tidbit to know for your exam. So the HIV virus, unfortunately for you, it gets into the cell. Okay, viruses, they usually have like some kind of coats, all right, so they remove their blazer, if you will, so they uncoat. Okay, and because it's a single-stranded RNA virus, it needs to be converted to DNA to have the ability to integrate into the genome. So that's done by reverse transcriptase. Remember, reverse transcriptase is an RNA-dependent DNA polymerase, okay, which can be inhibited by NRTIs, like lamivudine or zidovudine. So these are basically DNA polymerase inhibitors, okay? But the DNA polymerase in this case is RNA dependent, okay? And lamivudine, zidovudine, I just put those there to show you that those are NRTIs. And I'll call your attention to the fact that lamivudine also is used to treat the Hep B virus, okay? Because remember, hepatitis B also has its own DNA polymerase. Okay, you can also non-competitively inhibit the reverse transcriptase with drugs known as NNRTIs, right? So the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors like levirapine and efavirenz. Remember, efavirenz is a teratogen, so don't give it to a pregnant woman. And also remember that it causes vivid dreams, right? So it's neurotoxic. Okay, so you make that DNA, you integrate it into the genome with integrase. Okay, integrase can be inhibited by your Gravir drugs, right? So like dolutegravir, raltegravir, elvitegravir, and stuff like that. Okay, and then you replicate that genome. And then when you replicate that genome, you do your mRNA business, and then you form a polypeptide. Okay, that polypeptide is useless to HIV. Okay, that polypeptide needs to be chopped into specific proteins. Okay, and that's done by a protease enzyme. And that protease enzyme, it so happens, is inhibited by protease inhibitors. Okay, so drugs like ritonavir, for example, remember, ritonavir is a powerful inhibitor of cytochrome P450, and it also causes some fat redistribution, right? So they call it like a lipodystrophy, if you may. Okay, so you make those new proteins, you package that into variants, okay, and then you rinse and repeat. Okay, and again, remember that HIV, like most other viruses, does in fact derive its envelope from the plasma membrane. Okay, remember we said that pox viruses are sort of special, that they make their own membrane, and then the herpes virus is sort of unusual in the sense that it gets its membrane from the nucleus. Okay, so it takes its envelope from the nuclear membrane. Okay, and then on the bottom, I talk about the genes and what they encode, right? So like GP120 and GP41 are encoded by the ONV gene, okay? The POL gene encodes RIP, so that's an easy way to remember that, reverse transcriptase, integrase, and protease. And then the GAG gene encodes the P24 capsid and the P17 matrix protein. Okay, the P24 protein is actually what's detected in the ELISA test for HIV. Okay, so for our last slide, now that we've talked about HIV and you sort of know the life cycle and some of its pharmacology, let's talk about the HIV family of diseases. These are super, 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 super high yield for your exam. So Candida, right, classically causes a thrush. It can also cause an esophagitis in HIV patients, and you treat that with a nystatin swish and swallow. Okay, EBV can cause an oral hairy leukoplakia. Remember, that does not scrape off. We talked about that. We also talked about how EBV can cause a primary CNS lymphoma. Okay, so that classically shows up on MBMEs, not in the real world, but on MBMEs as a solitary ring-enhancing lesion in an AIDS patient. Okay, CMV, we said it can cause a retinitis, right? So if you see like cotton wool spots on fundoscopic exam in an AIDS patient, think about CMV retinitis. If they tell you that, oh, a person has a difficulty swallowing and they're an AIDS patient, and they say, oh, you do an endoscopy with biopsy and you see linear ulcers, also think of CMV. Okay, pneumocystis jirovetsi, right? So this is causes interstitial pneumonia in AIDS patients. Remember, for that you want to prophylax with CD4 count less than 200 with trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. And classically, P. jirovetsi, right, causes like an elevated LDH. And if they tell you, oh, you do a bronchoalveolar lavage in an AIDS patient presenting with respiratory symptoms, and you see silver stain positive organisms, again, you're thinking about pneumocystis jirovetsi. And while we're on the topic of silver stains, there are other high-yield bugs that stain positive with silver that you probably want to know for your exam, right? So we've talked about pneumocystis jirovetsi. I remember H. pylori is also silver stain positive. And also remember Legionella pneumophila. That is also silver stain positive, okay? Now, lobar consolidation with high fevers in an AIDS patient. If you see that, I can almost bet you that your friends at the MBME will put P. jirovetsi as an answer. Do not pick that. For all intents and purposes, on MBMEs, pneumocystis jirovetsi causes an interstitial pneumonia. Okay? If you see a lobar consolidation, high fevers, AIDS patients, CD4 count less than 200, you want to pick strep pneumo as your answer, not P. jirovetsi. Okay? Lobar consolidation, AIDS patient, strep pneumo. Okay? Now, coccidioides imidis, this is one of those dimorphic fungi. The only reason I put this here is that it can cause a pulmonary infection in AIDS patients. So if you live in a susceptible area, right? So let's say you live in like Arizona or Las Vegas or I guess Nevada or California or Texas, and you have a CD4 count less than 250, you want to go ahead and get prophylaxis against the C. imidis, okay? CD4 count less than 250, and you want to take itraconazole for that. Now, histoplasmosis, same deal. It can cause a pulmonary infection. And just real quick, remember you see spherules on histology in a person that has a coccidioides infection, Okay, for H. capsulatum, you classically see that in like Kentucky, or a person that goes spelunking or has been exposed to pigeons. Okay, so caves, spelunking, Kentucky, Ohio River Valley, those are sort of your associations there. You want to prophylax again in a person that lives in a susceptible area, not everyone, susceptible area, at a CD4 count less than 150 with itraconazole. Okay, and then meningitis in an AIDS patient, hopefully you're thinking of Cryptococcus neoformans. Okay, remember the soap bubble appearance on India ink staining. Okay, step one has also introduced the dye, it's called like the oramine something something stain for Cryptococcus. So you can look that up on your own. But remember, it's encapsulated. Okay, soap bubble appearance on India ink staining. And you classically treat that with amphotericin B and 5-fluocytosine. Remember, 5-fluocytosine is that drug that's acted on by cytosine deaminase to 5-FU. And then 5-FU then goes ahead and inhibits thymidylate synthase. So you're basically giving the AIDS patient an anti-cancer drug. Okay. Now, they're in an AIDS patient. Hopefully, you're thinking of Cryptosporidium parvum. Okay. So the classic description is an AIDS patient that got exposed to contaminated water. And then they have this very prolonged, very long-lasting, foul-smelling, watery diarrhea. And then they say, oh, you see acid fast ulcers in the stool. If you see that, think about Cryptosporidium parvum. And the way you treat that is with a drug known as a nitazoxanide. Okay. So it's acid fast. Now, Kaposi's sarcoma, right? We've talked about that. So that's herpes 8. Don't mistake that for bacillary angiomatosis, right? So that can also present as purplish skin lesions in an AIDS patient that hurts cats. Okay, remember, that's carried by Bartonella henselae. Okay, and if you do a biopsy, you'll see neutrophils, not lymphocytes, which is what you see in KSHV. So KSHV has lymphocytes. Bacillary angiomatosis has neutrophils on biopsy of one of the skin lesions. Okay, and then remember the GC virus can cause a progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy. Classically, if your CD4 count is less than 50, there is unfortunately no treatment for that. The only thing that may rescue you there is if you are placed on heart therapy. Okay, and then if you see multiple ring enhancing lesions on an MRI in an AIDS patient, hopefully you're thinking of Toxoplasma gondii. Okay, so toxoplasmosis. Remember that this is treated with a mixture of pyrimethamine, which is a dihydrofolate reductase inhibitor, and sulfadiazine, which is a dihydropterate synthetase inhibitor. Okay. Remember, if people have bone marrow suppression from getting those drugs, you probably want to go ahead and give them leucovorin to rescue the bone marrow. And those drugs certainly have sulfur allergies. And because your sulfonamide is a powerful oxidizing agent, you want to go ahead and maybe avoid those in patients with a history of G6PD deficiency. Okay, and then a CD4 count less than 50, that's kind of non-specific, but I'm trying to get you to think of Mycobacterium avium complex, also known as Mycobacterium avium intracellulare. Okay, you can prophylax against that when your CD4 count is less than 50 with macrolide. Okay, so a 50S inhibitor like azithromycin. Okay, you give azithromycin, CD4 count less than 50, and you prophylax against that nasty bugger. Okay, so I believe this is the end of this. So this is part A of the viral cases. There'll be probably be a part B and a part C. Okay, and hopefully by the end of these viral podcasts, you'll feel very comfortable with all the viral information that is classically tested on step one. Please let me know if you spot any errors or if you have any questions. I wish you all the best. I know step one is a stressful exam, but you know, just take it a day at a time, work really hard, learn your first aid, learn your pathoma, learn your U world, and hopefully things work out for the best. Okay, and hopefully I'll see you on the other side. Have a wonderful evening and goodbye.